Surrounded by an elegant 345-foot-long suspension bridge for pedestrians, the Liberty Bridge, conceived of by the same firm that designed Boston's Bunker Hill Memorial Bridge.
There's a parade of bronze statues along Main Street, which affected us the way it was probably intended to, giving us an excuse to slow down and even linger a bit, taking in the story of the town as we walked from one block to the next. There's Max Heller, the 1970s town visionary who rose from janitor to entrepreneur to civic leader and imagined how downtown would look today. There's Joel Poinsett, a diplomat, legislator, and botanist who brought the eponymous plant from Mexico to root it forever in the U.S. holiday season. There's shoeless Joe Jackson, who spent 3 decades disputing his part in the Black Sox scandal of 1919. He removed his cleats from his blistered feet during a game in Greenville. You'll pass him on the way to Fluor Field, which Knox White had told us about, and which is now the new home of the Class A Boston Red Sox affiliate, the Greenville Drive. Roy Fluorer, a leading figure in Greenville arts, helped me begin to understand what art can mean not only to a community's own sense of itself, but to all those who happen to come by there. Art, he said, lets the world know that there's a community in South Carolina that values the human soul. That's true of many other towns where we had been or would visit. Bronze statues of presidents in Rapid City, the gateway to Mount Rushmore. Statues of gunslingers, desperados, and Wild West characters in silhouettes and statues in Dodge City. A peace walk with larger-than-life statues of larger-than-life heroes like Gandhi and Martin Luther King Jr. in Riverside, California. Statues representing the remarkable and everyday people and moments of the town's history in Holland, Michigan. We continued on to the Swamp Rabbit Trail along the Reedy River. You see everything on that trail. Fit bikers, wedding photo shoots, strollers pushed by moms and by nannies from France and Germany. Old folks strolling hand in hand, especially along the easy-for-walkers rubbery stretch of the trail. If you look high up on the wooded hill, across from Liberty Falls, you'll see a collection of striking buildings in a campus-like, idyllic green setting, yet nearly in the middle of town. Oh, that's the Governor's School, people told us with pride. The Governor's School for the Arts and Humanities is a public boarding school specializing in the arts. Dance, drama, visual arts, music, and creative writing. To repeat, a public boarding school. It was founded as a summer program in 1980 by musician, teacher, and apparent force of nature Virginia Aldrich, who had a vision of creating a non-traditional arts conservatory. Greenville donated more than 8 beautiful acres, the former site of the Furman University Men's Campus. The $27 million Aldrich campus opened in the fall of 1999 to its first class of juniors. There's a loose network of a few dozen governor's schools around the country. They're all a bit different. Some are summer programs only. Others, like Greenville's, are for juniors and seniors. Some focus on the arts and humanities, others on science and math. South Carolina has one of each. They are all supported by a combination of state funds and private donations. Students in Greenville pay modest fees as they are able. The students are admitted from all over South Carolina, some from larger towns like Greenville and Columbia, others from towns that kids describe as remote, being mapped in their parts as near the third bend in the river. Some students arrive with impressive portfolios or experience at the Governor's School summer program. Others are discovered in the old-fashioned way by admissions officers who scour the state. According to school officials, about a third of the students qualify for free or reduced lunch. I was told that the school naturally attracts mostly lower and middle class students because it is a harder sell to kids from the wealthier families who don't want to give up their own rooms, cars, and TVs. The school complex is, in a word, stunning. There are multiple dance studios, a performance hall, art spaces for silversmithing and ceramics, a brass foundry, more studios for drawing, music rooms for practicing, a computer lab for graphic design, a gorgeous library, and ad lib rehearsal areas in the broad, glassed-in halls. One of the days I visited, a student violinist was playing on the stage in the theater, performing for her peers and a guest artist. The Visitor, who would be featured that evening as part of a public series that is a draw for many Greenville residents, was critiquing the young violinist's performance. We tiptoed into an art room where a 70-something male model, clad only in running shorts and with a musculature that made you wonder how he could be for real, stood statue still while students sketched him. We watched a practice session preparing drama students for upcoming auditions in Chicago. One young woman was performing Desdemona for the drama teacher and her fellow students. The teacher was tough on her, describing the changes he was looking for and instructing her to try it again at least 3 times before we slipped out. She was tough right back. "They break you down and build you back up," another student told me. This is a school for those with passion. Several students talked about their transition from feeling disengaged and out of sync in their hometown high schools to being wholly consumed, involved, and at home in this place, the likes of which they had never imagined. They called themselves Govies. The students are driven, or more accurately, they drive themselves. "One half dream, one half plan," is how one student described his life at the school. Dreaming big at the Governor's School means Broadway, Hollywood, Carnegie Hall, Pulitzer, Pritzker. Planning big means half of every day in practice, rehearsal, studio, workshop, training, rewrite, instruction, all alongside the usual high school academics. The dance teacher described the commitment, even obsession, of her students. "You're a dancer from the minute you get up in the morning," she said. And the dancers, some as young as 15 years old, told me how they orient and ground themselves day by day. "This is how I think of myself. Dance is the place I go to work through my issues. I am comfortable here." By the metrics, the Governor's School has proven itself. National merit finalists, presidential scholars in the arts, 100% acceptance to colleges or professional schools, including RISD, Juilliard, Eastman, Peabody Conservatory, and awards and scholarships of all sorts. Many alumni are already on their way to successful careers on the stage, on the screen, and in television.
Upstate South Carolina is politically conservative, to put it mildly. Greenville County was the very last one in South Carolina, which was the very last state, to observe Martin Luther King's birthday as a holiday. Mitt Romney beat Barack Obama by 10 points in South Carolina and by 28 points in Greenville County, whose rural areas are even more conservative than the city. Donald Trump carried the state by 15 points over Hillary Clinton and the county by 25. Bob Jones University is based in Greenville. The area's congressional representatives have included Jim DeMint and Trey Gowdy. But the political divisions and passions remained remarkably separate from the area's effort to attract new businesses and improve the community. "Whatever happens here, it has to be about business," Nancy Whitworth, the city's director of economic development since the 1990s, told us. "This has always been a business-first town." So how does such a town account for the record of its success? We heard the answer many times each day. The power of public-private partnerships. It was public-private partnerships that brought the big manufacturers to South Carolina, that made the downtown come alive, that are now supporting high-tech incubators in the city and science and engineering programs in the public schools. The bigger surprise, other than the major factories, involves all the aspects of civic life that have evolved here. These range from public art to environmental and public space initiatives to a revitalized downtown that urban planning teams from around the world visit to study, to the in-town minor league baseball stadium, to educational innovations we have not seen in other places and had not anticipated here. There is a larger lesson. To wit, if we can find ways to name strategies so that they sound acceptable and soothe rather than raise hackles, we can get a surprising amount done. Had a politician labeled Greenville strategy "picking winners" or "industrial policy," it would have been stillborn. As a series of public-private partnerships, it is a source of civic pride.
It was hard to get people in Greenville to actually name a school we should visit, they would demur with a kind of, "We love all our children equally," tone. There were just so many good ones, they would go on, the magnet schools, the STEM schools, art schools, charter schools, IB schools, etc. But one sounded irresistible. The A.J. Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering. That's right, engineering. Wittenberg is a public school that sits at the edge of the city's central area, which was described to me as highly distressed, meaning high poverty, unemployment and crime, and lots of single-parent households. The school is located next door to the expansive Salvation Army Ray and Joan Kroc Corps Community Center, Kroc as in McDonald's, where the students can walk for lessons in swimming, golf, rock climbing, tennis, and soccer. The school is also a 10-minute walk along the Swamp Rabbit Trail to the Peace Center of the Performing Arts, which coordinates with Wittenberg on special projects with the children. When Wittenberg was preparing to open in 2010, few people had gotten wind of it. High schoolers were hired to canvass the school's neighborhood, introducing the school to parents and encouraging them to enroll their youngsters. By the second year, word was out, and out-of-district parents camped in front of the school for a week before registration, hoping to secure a first-come, first-served spot. The demand was so high that the local Lowe's home store offered discounts on camping supplies. Registration day spun out of control. Videos showed parents stampeding the door when they opened. The next year, the school switched to a lottery system. Now, a Wittenberg administrator told me, Greenville real estate agents advertise the location as a plus for houses listed in the Wittenberg district. Wittenberg is a beneficiary of the business, manufacturing, and higher education mecca that is Greenville. This is where the city's corporations, private donors, government agencies, NGOs, and universities demonstrate their deep commitment to public education and the future workforce of Greenville. Wittenberg alone lists more than 36 partners, including General Electric, Michelin, BMW, Duke Energy, Lockheed Martin, Fluor, the Greenville Drive, Hubble Lighting, Jacobs Engineering, Furman, Whole Foods, and Walmart. During January's Engineering Week, young professionals from GE were on campus, wearing purple t-shirts and teaching lessons. That week, they were teaching about hydro, wind, and solar power sources. One volunteer, who looked about the age that the kids' dads would be, was boiling water in a glass beaker. This produced steam, which drove a pinwheel to spin. Another was demonstrating the evolution of light bulbs, measuring the amount of heat the bulbs produced, and engaging fourth graders in a discussion of what it meant to a bulb that much of its energy was spent on producing heat instead of light. It was an example of how engineering is folded into every available step of Wittenberg's traditional academic curriculum. The school halls can be disorienting. The walls of the fourth and fifth grade corridor are bare, except for digital screens. In fact, almost everything in the fourth and fifth grade is digital. All the schoolwork is done on tablets. Students enter their work into folders. Teachers use a stylus to comment on the work. And parents are encouraged to open the folders and monitor the entirety of their children's work. The kids are introduced to their digital world from the get-go. Kindergartners begin practicing on unplugged keyboards. By second grade, they each have a personal iPad. Soon they learn PowerPoint, which is a favorite application of every engineer I've ever watched give a presentation. The students learn block letter printing, but not cursive. When I talked with the administrators about the absence of cursive, which even they had originally questioned, they told me they'd realized that the only necessary example for cursive in the children's future lives would be a signature, which they could print and block letters. Writing letters in cursive? Nope, they'll type them. Research notes? Nope, laptops. I tried to think of one to stump them. The first graders showcased the synergy between engineering and the Greenville arts scene. The nearby Peace Center, named for its original donors, the local Peace family, with its broad outdoor plaza and welcoming glass atrium, features a Broadway series each year. That year, one play was to be The Wizard of Oz. First graders at Wittenberg were studying the production from every angle. They studied the physics of getting the Wicked Witch up into the air. They broke into teams to design their own rope and pulley systems to hoist a flying witch. They marched the Swamp Rabbit Trail to the Peace Center to learn how stage lighting works, how the orchestra pit operates, how the scenery is set up. They all learned the songs from the musical. They read the book. They made their own pop-up books of the story. The winning design team earned tickets to a performance at the theater. In 2013, the LEGO Robotics team won the right to compete in Germany, the only elementary school in the United States to do so. This meant the first airplane flights and first passports for lots of kids. They returned with so much excitement that, not surprisingly, now everyone wants to be on the LEGO Robotics team. The mascot of the school is a robot, and the team members are called the Engineers. Environmental service is a school-wide effort. First graders compost. Second graders collect recycling waste from classrooms every Thursday. They sort it, count it, and rate the classroom's recycling bins, awarding points for the volume of recycled material and logging demerits for candy wrappers. Third graders measure air quality and post signs outside promoting a no-idling campaign for cars. Fourth graders study water quality and give instructive PowerPoint presentations to the other classes. A curious fact, at least four people in Greenville told me that the city boasts the best-tasting water in North America. No one could tell me where that accolade comes from, but the water was good enough that everyone we saw ordered tap water over bottled water, even at high-end restaurants. Fifth graders learned how to conduct home energy audits. The kids and adults built an organic garden out behind the school, including a greenhouse constructed of recycled plastic bottles. They learned to categorize food as green, yellow, and red. Go, slow, and whoa, to help them understand proteins, veggies, low-sugar fruit, carbs, high-sugar fruit, cookies and cakes, and to plan their own menus. They bake their own bread and make their own homemade soup. That year, they planned to launch a project to grow and harvest cotton, tying that process into the history of textile mills of yore here in the upstate of South Carolina. Rounding out the curriculum is art. Many lower-grade corridor walls explode with 3D extravaganzas. The children have created all manner of decor. There are paper trees growing out of walls, fluffy snowmen popping out, suspended robots, and mystery things that protrude and hang and dangle. Each classroom of the lower grades that I entered was a creative heaven. Sculptures hanging from ceilings, bursts of color everywhere. Students busy at various workstations. Clusters of buzzing activity, books, furniture, photos, and a lone and empty thinking chair. When the kids age out of Wittenberg, some go on to the brand new Finnissy J. Fisher Middle School, which recently opened with a STEAM curriculum, adding the A for arts to the more familiar science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM curriculum. STEM versus STEAM is a hot topic in the education world. Proponents of STEAM argue that infusing more liberal arts into a highly technical curriculum will build more well-rounded, richer lives for the students. Part of the push to STEAM for Fisher came from Greenville's business community, which wanted to nurture a future workforce steeped in the world of technology, but also one that would be comfortable and practiced in the softer skills of communicating, teamwork, organizing, and public speaking. Fisher is on the east side of town, adjacent to the campus of Clemson University's International Center for Automotive Research. Is that a school? Is a question that Fisher's principal, Jane Garrow, says she often hears people ask as they drive by the award-winning modernistic glass buildings, which don't look like a conventional school. The buildings were designed around the curriculum, she explains, rather than the other way around. If you took several walks around Fisher's complex, you'd be likely to see something different each time, even over the course of a day. Classrooms have big glass-paneled garage doors, which lower for a cozier feel, or rise to create an open space with adjoining common areas. Tables and chairs can be pushed around and fit together like puzzle pieces. Indoor-outdoor classroom spaces and an innovation lab are so big that you can drive a car right inside them. The school is bright and airy. Its lighting responds automatically to the degree of sunlight pouring in. The infrastructure of the buildings is exposed. brightly painted ceiling pipes, color-coded for their functionality, and see-through walls into electrical closets let the children absorb lessons in engineering just by walking around their school. Students work in red, blue, or green so-called learning communities, where classrooms can spill into those big shared spaces. There are studios, design labs, arts and media centers, and music and seminar rooms. There is no need for student lockers because the laptops, which hold e-books and digital papers and homework, can easily fit into a backpack. Those were strewn about kid style or lined up against the walls. Fisher's STEAM curriculum is taught through a method called Project-Based Learning, PBL. Students address a real-world challenge or problem and then go on to explore and respond to it. They are encouraged to collaborate, think critically, be creative, and solve problems. Anne Kelsey Zybert, a veteran teacher of 12 years and a newly trained PBL teacher, took me step by step through an example of project-based learning in her class. The students were studying World War I, and Kelsey Zybert wanted her students to connect real, everyday life in those times to the actual events they were studying. The students would construct a tool or artifact of the era using today's materials and then present the object to the class. This exercise would fold in research, design, construction, writing an essay about their creation and its relation to the historical event, and then making a public presentation to the class. With a kind of Shark Tank twist, each student received $1,000, fake of course, to invest in their favorite project, the one they found most promising. One was a bazooka-like gun, one was a tinfoil-covered submarine, and another was an extensive medical kit for field use. Like Wittenberg, Fisher benefits from strong Greenville community involvement. Employees from Michelin were at Fisher the day I visited, demonstrating catapults to the middle schoolers. Zike, a Greenville company that makes a human-powered hybrid scooter bike, donated 20 bikes to the school. Another local company donated a 3D printer. Staff and faculty at the next-door campus of Clemson offer tours and mentorships to Fisher, and some Clemson professors hold regular office hours on their campus for Fisher faculty members. That same day was the morning after a huge winds had blasted through Greenville in a fierce overnight rainstorm. Outside, clusters of sixth graders were picking up and patching together the remnants of shelters they had designed and built from found goods, like cardboard, plastic bags, wooden pallets, and old newspapers. They discovered that the location of some of their shelters, a protected-looking corner near the outdoor amphitheater, actually turned out to be a wind tunnel. The storm had wreaked havoc on the shelters, injecting a big dose of reality, as the students must have considered how lucky they were not to have actually been sleeping out overnight. These issues, construction, shelters, wind tunnels, weather, homelessness, were on the students' minds as they were concurrently reading a popular novel called Maniac McGee, about an orphan looking for a home and woven through with themes of homelessness and racism. At Fisher, the library is called the Media Center. The space is drenched with light from the two-story windows and is the first thing you notice driving up to the school. Inside, kids can curl into comfy sofas or sprawl on colorful rugs. There are relatively few actual books. The director of the center told me that Fisher students were comfortable with the style and operations of the Media Center, which means doing their research, browsing for books, reading, and producing their papers mostly digitally.
In Burlington and Sioux Falls, we began wondering why high-value companies end up where they do, and how and where new companies get their start. In Greenville, we spent a very interesting afternoon at the locally well-known firm The Iron Yard, which was housed in a new tech incubator building that said NEXT out front. The NEXT program was run by the Greenville Chamber of Commerce, with public-private guidance from local officials, businesses, developers, and so on. But it is located separately from the main Chamber of Commerce building, and is designed to look and feel like a startup center in Boston, San Francisco, Brooklyn, or southern China, rather than some standard corporate building. When we visited, John Moore, a chamber executive who runs NEXT, told us that it tried to run in a lean startup style too, We had the advantage of starting with a blank sheet of paper, he said. Because there were no existing entities to protect their turf, we were able to leapfrog. Much as some developing countries jump entirely past the wired telephone stage to create nationwide wireless networks. Moore said, we went from the idea for the center to finishing the building and opening it to having it full all within 3 years. If we'd had to start with a university or an existing city facility and tried to change its model, it would have been a lot harder and slower. The purpose of Next is to make it easier for new companies to get a foothold in the Greenville area. Moore pointed out that while this upstate region of South Carolina has become famously effective in recruiting big established firms like GE, BMW, and Michelin, we may not have done enough to develop our own. Next and related enterprises connect startups with angel investors, provide physical space for them to get off the ground, offer advice from mentors and startup veterans, and generally supply the sort of surrounding entrepreneurial information and advantage that can come automatically from being in startup centers from Boston to San Francisco. Had it made any difference? Can it make any difference, I asked Moore, given the scale and distance handicaps of a smallish place like Greenville? If you'd asked me 5 years ago, during the toughest times economically, I would have said, I hope so, Moore told us. We had 8 software companies in our program in 2006. They hadn't known each other. Now we have 134 companies, all new, in all kinds of industries, from manufacturing to genomics to game software. He said that he expected 200 local startups to be involved with Next soon. The main building is spaced for only 20 to 24. The rest are part of a network for advice, financing, and other services. Moore said the companies Next is looking for are ones that can compete on a global scale but are based here. They're now coming without recruiting, he noted. It's become a kind of flywheel. The momentum, the acceleration, it all shows the potential. But of course, I'm from the Chamber of Commerce, so you'd expect me to say that. Indeed. But then he put it in more tangible terms, gesturing to an office across the hall. A few years ago, he said, people like Eric Dodds would never have stayed here. Eric Dodds, whom we met at the Next building, is a co-founder and chief marketing officer of The Iron Yard, a multi-purpose software startup based in Greenville that also had operations in Spartanburg, nearby Asheville, North Carolina, and other southeastern locations. Dodds grew up in Greenville and always dreamed of getting away. Boulder, Portland, that's where my people would be, he told us. Then, after going to Clemson and working for national branding companies, he came back and noticed that the place where he'd started out had changed. The Iron Yard's co-founder and CEO, Peter Barth, grew up in Florida and had worked in New York and the Midwest and was planning to work in Charlotte. He stopped in Greenville for lunch, walked through its famously renovated downtown, and decided that this was where he wanted to stay. The Iron Yard's business model was a combination of Code Academy, business incubators, kids' classes, and other features. The Code Academy charged $10,000 for a 3-month session and offered a full refund if graduates could not get an appropriate job. Barth told us, we can guarantee an entry-level job, but entry-level in this field might be $65,000 or $75,000. In the years after we met Dodds and Barth, the Iron Yard expanded very rapidly across the South and into the Midwest. Then, in the summer of 2017, as part of a general contraction of Code Academies, it said it would suspend operations by the end of the year. Some startups succeed, most fail. The significance of the Iron Yard story was what it showed about this area's ability to attract and retain people like Barth and Dodds, whom you would normally expect to find in Boulder, Portland, or Boston. Greenville is great once you get here, but it can be hard to get people to come and take a look, Peter Barth told us. Greenville, are you kidding? Eric Dodds added, it's been really interesting rubbing shoulders with people in our classes who say, I've gotten here, I'm going into your program, and this is my ticket out. Then, after a while, they say, I've seen this culture, I think I'm going to stay around here. After several visits to Greenville, we began thinking of the places it reminded us of and differed from. The resemblance started unexpectedly with a place we had visited only a few weeks before, Burlington. In principle, you would compare Greenville and the upstate with Burlington and northern Vermont only to highlight the unbridgeable chasms in American politics. One of the most right-leaning regions versus one of the most left-leaning. But if you looked at Burlington and Greenville as cities, for their amenities and feel and civic sense, and for the history of public-private interactions behind today's cityscapes, you would find more similarities than you might expect. The waterfront is very important to the character of each town. The Reedy River and its waterfalls in Greenville's case, Lake Champlain in Burlington's. 30 years ago, the cities were similar in that their waterfronts were off-putting rather than attractive. Greenville's because of the highway that made it hard for people to get to the river, Burlington's because of the railroad right-of-way that ran along the lake. The shopping, cultural, and recreational life of each city and its surrounding region now centers on its lively downtown. Greenville's is called Main Street, Burlington's is Church Street, but with allowances for the difference in climate, you would have a hard time telling them apart. As with the waterfronts, these were deliberate public-private creations. Led by strong mayors, each city changed the physical look of the street, redid parking arrangements, commissioned public art, ran concerts and fairs, and took the lead in bringing new life to a battered downtown. Each city has a very popular minor league baseball team. Greenville has a software and design startup community with a critical mass of entrepreneurs who have chosen a smaller town life. Burlington has a critical mass of entrepreneurs who have chosen the outdoor life and political tone of Vermont. Both cities have commercial airports that are bigger and nicer than you might expect, given the city's size, yet small enough to be quick and convenient to travel through. And despite their deep dissimilarities on most issues of national politics, the leaders and voters of each city have relied steadily on public-private partnerships, in which state and city governments have taken active steering roles for corporate and philanthropic efforts. And what about the contrasts? For all of Greenville's likenesses to Burlington, we saw differences with the other major city of the upstate, Spartanburg, some 30 miles to the east. They have roughly the relationship of Dallas and Fort Worth, or Minneapolis and St. Paul, with the larger, richer city of each pair, Greenville in this case, unavoidably looking down on its neighbor, which in turn looks right back with pride in its scrappy authenticity. Midway between Greenville and Spartanburg is the tiny former textile town of Greer, which is the home of the BMW factory, the major commercial airport for the region, and the brand new inland port, which offers shippers a streamlined, speedy rail connection to the ocean port 200 miles away in Charleston. Greer is also the closest attempt in the region to replicate the Greenville formula. If you have seen the Greenville model, the parallels in Greer are evident. First, the problem, the collapse of the textile business that had been the local mainstay. Then the response, via a public-private effort that Greer calls the Partnership for Tomorrow to rebuild the downtown, which is tiny but has most of its original brick structures. "We're very fortunate to still have good bones intact," said Rick Danner, who ran a landscape design firm in Greer and then worked for a local bank and had been Greer's mayor since 2000. He was referring to Greer's classic American turn-of-the-century downtown architecture. That's been the foundation for our downtown revitalization plans. Create new parks and public spaces, invest in infrastructure for the long run. Apart from the Inland Port, a joint project between a railroad company and the South Carolina Ports Authority, the local airport, Greenville-Spartanburg International, is the most dramatic instance of a long-term public-private bet. When I first saw it from above, en route to the small airport in downtown Greenville, I assumed it must once have been a strategic air command base, so enormous were its runway and surrounding buffer of open land. In fact, it was a purely local undertaking, led by the Spartanburg textile magnate Roger Milliken, who decided in the late 1950s that the upstate needed an airport that would never limit its potential growth. They said, "Let's not only build an airport, let's build one that will be here for generations," Rick Danner said of the Public-Private Airport Commission, led by Milliken, that developed the airport. Milliken was still locally active until 2010, when he died at age 95. They own 3,500 acres of land all around it for expansion, Danner noted. Their land reaches right to the inland port, and they have a literal 50-year plan updated continuously for how they intend to grow. The good news is that it was possible to do all this, Stephen Brandt of the Greenville News told us about the recovery process in Greenville and by extension in Greer and other small towns like Travelers Rest and Duncan. He added, the bad news for anyone trying to do it overnight is that it required a purposeful and organic process for more than 30 years with so many shoulders to the wheel.
St. Mary's, Georgia. We were warmed up to the extravagance of Southern talk by the time we flew south to Georgia and spent a day in the Okefenokee Swamp. Our guide, a veteran of swamp tours, worked his language for all it was worth. He knew everything about the swamp. There was plenty to talk about. Mama gators, baby gators, little old bitty baby gators, each with a little old tooth on the end of its nose. He was swamp-wise, or swamp-wise, as he pronounced it, his diphthongs sliding off into long, slow, single monophthong vowels. The I sound, which northerners like me pronounce as the diphthong I, in words like nine, right, stripe, mile, I, and five, become ah, to produce like, nine, right, stripe, mile, ah, five. Those words popped up in his swamp lessons about cypress knees and the value of pine straw, or when he pointed out moonshine islands where old-timers made white lightning. There was also an issue of how our guide would address us. He alternated between y'all and guys, with a few you guys thrown in for good measure. In just 3 minutes by my watch, I counted 7 uses of y'all and 7 of guys. From the treasure trove of the very popular 2003 Harvard Dialect Survey, I learned that the favored term around the country as the way of addressing a group of two or more people is you guys. Some 43% of people say that nationwide, compared with a mere 11% in Georgia. By contrast, 71% of Georgians choose y'all, as compared with 14% nationwide. The study didn't offer guys as an option, just you guys. That was 2003, and popular language can change quickly. As we moved through the South, I heard plenty of all these terms, including lots of variations. My favorite is the possessive form, you guyses.
Around the world, when people think of coastal Georgia, they are likely to think of the resorts at Hilton Head, or the wildlife preserves of Sapelo and Cumberland Islands, or the stylishness of Savannah. Deb and I think of those places as well, especially Savannah, where long ago we spent several months as young volunteers on a Ralph Nader project, combating pollution in the broad and now much cleaner Savannah River. But we also think of the little town of St. Mary's, the scene of literal life and death dramas in that same period. The small town of St. Mary's, Georgia, differs from the other places we have visited in the basic structure of its economy. When we first went there in the 1970s, it was still what it had been for many decades, a company town, in the good and mostly bad senses of that term. Now it has become a surprising variant of the same thing, a small-town economy whose well-being revolves around one huge employer. That is a circumstance the city and county officials were trying to change when we visited. Yet something else we discovered was the real surprise of the city for us. Back in the early 1970s, when a young Jimmy Carter was making his run for governor of Georgia, St. Mary was a caricature of the isolated southern Gothic company town. The company in charge was the Gilman Paper Company, which was a formidable political and economic force throughout the state and essentially its own law in the southeastern corner that included St. Mary's. Gilman Paper Company is the only major Georgia industry south of Brunswick and east of Waycross, its manager said in a speech that was reported in local papers around that time. It can safely be stated that not less than 75% of the economy of Camden County is directly dependent on Gilman Paper Company. In those days, St. Mary's was the most bleakly Dickensian of the places we visited. The mill paid good wages in exchange for all-encompassing political and social control. Its corporate attorney was also the state representative, and he was the county attorney, too. The result in tax policy and environmental regulation was predictable. The mill's manager was the local big man. The company's owners, the Gilman brothers of Manhattan, lived an art patron life far removed from the harshness of their family's company town. In the past few years, whenever I have gone to brutal, polluted, boss-run factory towns in remote China, I have thought back to St. Mary's. It wasn't that long ago that China's current reality was tolerated in the United States. The good of the old company town arrangement was that the giant mill of the Gilman Paper Company provided paychecks for the overwhelming majority of families in the area. Indeed, the air and water pollution was so heavy and the location was so remote that a job with Gilman was the most obvious reason anyone would choose to live there. The bad included not simply the expected distortions of a town entirely dependent on one company, but also a range of extra-legal offenses. One of those was hiring a hitman to eliminate a local critic, that critic being a man who became our friend, Wyman Westbury. The sequence of what happened is appropriately full of gothic convolutions, but in brief, the young millwright named Wyman Westbury, who had become disgusted by what we now consider China-scale despoliation of the local river and marshlands, drew press attention to what was happening in this little enclave. He called me in Savannah late one night. We went down to learn about his town, and we wrote about him in our report. Eventually, 60 Minutes and national and statewide media got interested in St. Mary's. In the midst of the furor, the local big men put out a contract to have Westbury killed. The going rate was $50,000, only the would-be hitman decided to keep the money but not carry out the hit. The administration of new Governor Jimmy Carter began paying attention, and at the end of a tale worthy of Elmore Leonard or Carl Hiaasen, Wyman Westbury ended up surviving and then prospering as a major real estate investor and entrepreneur, and much of the local establishment either ended up in prison or died before coming to trial.
In some ways, the city is unrecognizably different now. When we first visited, the pollution from the paper mill was so thick and caustic that, as in a scene from modern China, even the Spanish moss had been poisoned from the trees. Now the trees are once more heavily draped with moss. Back then, there was a perpetual layer of ash on cars and houses downwind of the mill. Now, the historic downtown of St. Mary's, the part not subject to strip mall sprawl a few miles away from I-95, has the little restaurants and shops of other aspiring revived downtowns we have seen, plus the Oak Grove Cemetery, just steps from the waterfront, which was founded when George Washington was president, and whose headstones, beneath oaks dripping with Spanish moss, record the different waves of residents, black and white, and the epidemics, wars, and other misfortunes that did them in. One part of its lore, which we heard from Kay Westbury, Wyman Westbury's ex-wife, on an extensive and partly spooky tour, is that during an epic flood in St. Mary's, the coffins from the black deceased, who had been interred in the low-lying part of the cemetery, floated up and out. The Gilman Paper Company is no more, not as a business entity, not as part of the physical landscape in St. Mary's. The family manager squabbled, the paper business itself was troubled. What had been the largest privately owned paper mill in America was sold to a Mexican firm, and soon thereafter that firm, too, declared bankruptcy. In 2002, the mill shut down, eliminating some 900 jobs. In 2007, the remains of the mill were blown up, despite some local efforts to retain and reuse them as startup sites, light industrial buildings, or even monuments. Piles of concrete are what remain. The good news for St. Mary's and surrounding Camden County was that another mammoth employer had arrived even before Gilman went down. That was the U.S. Navy. During the administration of the former submarine officer and loyal Georgia native Jimmy Carter, and with the support of Georgia Senators Sam Nunn and Herman Talmadge, then big powers on Capitol Hill, the U.S. Navy decided that Kings Bay, immediately north of St. Mary's, would be the East Coast home of America's nuclear submarine fleet. The West Coast home is near Seattle. Everything about the city was changed by the Navy's arrival. While in Gilman's heyday, the manager claimed that 75% of the people in the county owed their living directly to the mill, these days local officials told us that perhaps 70% of the regional economy was now related to the base, a figure that includes rental housing, retail, construction, and other spillover effects of growth itself. This is the part of small-town life that didn't change, the outsized importance of a single big gorilla economic engine. Gilman Paper Company, the previous gorilla, had been local but not in a good way. The local managers behaved as mini tyrants, and the owners lived in New York City and seemed to view the mill mostly as a hinterland source of wealth. The U.S. Navy, the current gorilla, is by all accounts faultlessly well-behaved and good citizen-like in its local relations. The submarine officers and seamen are an elite within the military, older, better educated, and more carefully selected than the norm, and not any source of trouble in town. But by definition, a military presence is transient, and while some Navy officials come back to the area after retirement, the Navy represents an economic power that is in but not of the town. Much of the growth it has induced has been just growth, malls, restaurants, fast food establishments, and the like on the fringes of town. The officials we met from St. Mary's and Camden County are perfectly well aware of the imbalanced nature of the local economy. One school official described it during the Gilman era as the Uncle Bubba phenomenon. She said, if a kid was slacking off in school, you couldn't tell him to try harder because he'd just say, my Uncle Bubba will get me a job at the mill. Uncle Bubba can't get people into the Navy. But another person noted, most places talked about economic development, but we really didn't need to worry about that. Around the time Kings Bay leveled off, the housing industry started to grow. We kind of thought, well, we don't need traditional economic development. We kind of got our eyes off the ball. But now, he said, we've looked in the mirror and for the first time in my life found the political will to pull together. People in the city said they are trying to think about using things they do have to foster the growth of what they now lack. Their ideas include several facets. Chief among them is the pretty downtown, which resembles better known and more popular resort cities, but with dramatically lower real estate costs. Tourists now troop into St. Mary's for holiday celebrations, like its classic 4th of July parade through the downtown, or they sail in along the Intracoastal Waterway, and to take the ferry over to Cumberland Island National Seashore, historically a resort for the Carnegie family. Plans are underway to add more attractions, hotels, and other local venues that would entice people to stay for a day or two, rather than just pass through. Of the entire Atlantic seaboard, this stretch of coastal Georgia is one of the best preserved and most beautiful parts, in addition to having great ecological significance for its wetlands. Beautiful places, especially by the coast, are increasingly where people with a choice of where to live want to live. You can rebuild infrastructure, but you can't manufacture an ocean view. The commercial space launch business is growing. According to local officials, this part of Georgia was in the running when Cape Canaveral was chosen as NASA's main site in the mid-20th century. And so they are making a 21st century push to build a new spaceport in a former industrial area and one-time Thiokol rocket test site just north of town, where companies like SpaceX would be able to launch their vehicles. But none of these seem to be embraced with the do-or-die spirit we have seen in some other small cities. What was revolutionary and served as an introduction to an important area of education was the local high school. The Camden County High School, or CCHS, is famous throughout Georgia for the success of its football team. But it's also home to a revived form of education, one that took us by surprise. CCHS is the only high school in the county, drawing a total of some 2,800 students from the cities of Kingsland, where it's located, St. Mary's, and Woodbine, plus unincorporated areas. Each year's graduating class is around 600 students. The school's size has helped make it a perennial athletic powerhouse. In the 10 years before our visit, it had won the state football championship 3 times. It had another advantage that I recognized from my own time as a student in a diverse community with only a single high school. In a region with relatively few private or religious schools, it provides an enforced region-wide communal experience across class and race, rather than the separation by suburb paradigm of many public schools. Demographically, the CCHS student body reflects the surrounding area, about one quarter black, most of the rest white, and small numbers of other ethnic groups, including from Navy-related families. According to school officials, about 40% of the students qualify for reduced-price lunches, and about 60% go to post-high school training of some sort. Each year, a small number go away to out-of-state schools, including selective ones. In 2001, only half of the school students graduated from high school. Now that is up to 85%, a change that Rachel Baldwin, the CCHS Career Academy Instructional Specialist who showed us around, attributed mainly to the school's application of programs from the Southern Regional Education Board. CCHS has the best AP, Advanced Placement Record, of high schools in its part of the state. What struck us about the school was the very practical-minded and well-supported embrace of what used to be called vocational education and now is called the career technical approach. In effect, what this meant was dividing a large, sprawling campus and student body into six academies, each with different emphases. One of them is the freshman academy to get the new students acclimated. "I don't know if you've seen ninth graders recently," one person there told us, "but some of them look big and old enough to be parents of some others. It's a big range, and it helps to have a special place for them." The other five academies each have a career technical emphasis. After freshman year, all students enroll in one of the five. While they still take the normal academic core range of subjects, they also get extensive and seemingly very well-equipped training in the realities of jobs they might hold. A few examples. In the Law and Justice curriculum, which is part of the Government and Public Service Academy, a former Navy Kings Bay NCIS official named Rich Gamble trained students in conducting mock crime investigations and in preparation for testimony in court. On the day we were there, he had staged a mock robbery in which the perp grabbed a cash box from an office, ran through the hallways, and dumped the box as he was escaping. The students acting out the scenario wore their white CSI lab coats so other teachers would know what they were up to. Then Gamble divided his students into three teams to investigate the crime, making plaster casts of footprints, taking evidence, filing reports, preparing a case. "We emphasize a lot of writing," he said. "I give them issues where they have to defend themselves in very few words because courts don't like you to waste words. Some of these papers are as good as any written by NCIS. In the Engineering, Architectural, and Industrial Academy, students design and build doghouses and other structures which they sell in the community, do welding and compete in state and national welding competitions, run an auto repair shop that handles county vehicles, do extensive electrical work, and complete other activities. This same academy also includes computer-aided design and robotics programs under the direction of Fred Mercier. We saw architectural models of houses that students had designed and built with 3D printers and robots they had entered in a national robotics competition. In the Health and Environmental Sciences Academy, students were preparing for a certification test by administering care to dummies representing nursing home patients. The other academies are business administration and fine arts. CCHS has an industrial-scale kitchen and catering facility overseen by a former Navy chef. It has a very large auditorium where students not only perform plays, dances, and concerts, but also learn to build scenery and make costumes. There are more illustrations, but the point is already clear. Here is why we found this interesting and surprising. Among the non-expert U.S. public, the conventional wisdom about today's educational system is more or less this. At the highest levels, it's very good, though always endangered by budget cuts and other problems. At the lower ends, it's in chronic crisis for budgetary and other reasons. And overall, it's not doing as much as it should, to prepare students for practical job skills, especially for the significant group who are not going to get four-year college degrees. Sure, the Germans are great at this with their apprenticeship programs and all, but Americans never take voc ed seriously. One high school doesn't prove a national trend. But what struck us at Camden County High was its resonance with developments we were seeing elsewhere. Serious training for higher value technical jobs. Non-college often serves as a catch-all term, covering everything from minimum wage or worse food service jobs to highly skilled, hands-on technical and engineering jobs that may be the next era's counterpart to the lost paradise of assembly line jobs that paid a family living wage in the 1950s and 1960s.
Columbus, Mississippi. After writing about the Greenville Governor School in our ongoing blog of travels, I opened my inbox one morning to find an email from Thomas Easterling, an English teacher at the Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science. In a gentlemanly southern way, Easterling was throwing down the gauntlet, basically saying, "You think the Governor's School in Greenville is so great? Come see ours in Mississippi." That was enough. We put Columbus, Mississippi on our map. We headed for Mississippi on Easter Sunday, feeling a little sorry for ourselves. Our families were gathered thither and yon. Somehow we couldn't make our timing work to get to any of the corners of the country where they were living. By chance, changes in the winds and weather pushed us toward a small runway in the middle of lush Georgia hills. This was KTOC, the Toccoa Stevens County Airport. We landed, and Jim taxied over to the fuel pump while I headed to the FBO, the universally used abbreviation for fixed base operator, the management of a small airport. Praying for at least a vending machine, the quaint brick building with a broad porch featured a row of deep plantation rocking chairs and suggested that people liked to gather there to watch the planes take off and land. I opened the door and then, a miracle. The aroma of roast ham and baking yams, macaroni and cheese and biscuits and pies. At the end of the hall, in one of the pilot's rooms, was a fully laid out potluck Easter banquet, part of a multi-generational, multi-family celebration. We gratefully accepted the host's southern hospitality to join them for a meal, including all of the above, plus greens, broccoli, creamed corn, deviled eggs, salads, and trimmings of all sorts. Some of the pilots strode out to look at our Cirrus. While this model of plane is not new to the market anymore, seeing one in person is often an attraction. Pilots are interested in the avionics and the parachute packed into the fuselage. Passengers admire the comfortable seats and big windows. As we were preparing to leave, Jim told the airport manager, "We feel very lucky to have ended up here just now." And he responded, "Or you could say you were blessed. You will remember us either way." Fat and happy, we flew toward the Lowndes County Airport in Columbus, Mississippi. By now, my patience for long, slow southern conversations was limitless. In fact, a few weeks later in Columbus, I spent some considerable time in an elevator with the housekeeper of the hotel floor where we were staying. She asked how I was doing. I replied and inquired back after her. A good 20 minutes later, after lots of pressing on the door open button so the conversation could continue, I had heard about her plans to attend an afternoon wedding. The dress she would be wearing, the flavor of cake that was under debate and finally ordered, and the likely number of guests and accoutrements like flowers and music. We approached Columbus slowly for landing. I could see the many, many church spires and the old downtown, which promised elegant antebellum houses with big, wide, columned porches. I could also spot the derelict, abandoned factories. We were so low on the approach that I could make out the tufts of weeds growing through the asphalt parking lots around them. We later learned that one was a factory where blue jeans had been stitched. Before that work, moved to the Caribbean. And in another, toilet seats had been made, until most of that work moved to Mexico. It was nearly Sunday evening by now, a slow day with no signs of life at the FBO. Finally, a guy came along in a pickup truck and offered us a ride into town, which we gratefully accepted. No taxis and no Ubers here.
In Mississippi, we knew that whatever economic challenges the whole country faced would appear in more acute form here, in what is chronically dead last in any economic ranking of the 50.